Today is Tuesday, May 10th, 2011. I am Pauline Adams, and I'm interviewing Kathleen Rout, Professor Emerita of the Department of American Thought and Language, now the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures at Michigan State University. Kay, can you tell us a little about your childhood, things like where you were born, where you grew up, your siblings and parents?
Sure. I was born in Syracuse, New York, and made my home in Salve, New York, which was a division, actually, of the Salve Process Division of Allied Chemical. It was originally a factory town, and then, of course, developed into an actual village in its own right, still just considered a village. My father was an accountant, and my mother, who was not allowed to work when she was married as a school teacher, went back to teaching in later years when I was in high school, I believe it was, or middle school, when they finally allowed married women to teach again in the public schools. She taught in high school. They both went to Syracuse University, and she went on and got a master's in education in order to be better equipped to make more money, and ended up head of the history department at her high school, which was West Genesee in Camillus, New York. I was born Kathleen Kinsella, and I was called KK as a little girl, and by my friends K, as the time wore on. Nobody ever called me Kathleen except school teachers and other people who were generally either reprimanding me or filling out a form. I was always bookish, but also extroverted to the extent that I hung around with as sprightly a group as I possibly could. My friends were all people like cheerleaders, and I was in a sorority when I was in high school. I think they're now forbidden, but in our day we had a lot of sororities and only one fraternity that got formed actually when I was there, called Pi Phi. I was in something called Salve Sub Deb. Or no, wait a minute. Salve Sub Deb was the other one. I was in Westvale Sub Deb, which was slightly one notch higher than Salve Sub Deb, partly because it included people from the other side of the tracks in the good sense, people who were from a slightly more suburban area. There were also a couple of others. But almost all my friends were in one of those sororities, and we all partied very, very heavily. We loved partying. And
wouldn't you say partying?
Yes.
When I was in school, partying meant something different than it has come to mean today. What does it mean, did it mean to you?
Well, we didn't know anything about drugs. So for us, partying meant alcohol and dancing. And both of those played a huge role. At the time, in upstate New York, in the state of New York, you could drink at 18, which means, of course, that it was very easy for people 15, 16, and 17 to get a hold of alcohol. In fact, we regularly purchased alcohol without anybody carding us. It was simply the way everything operated. As far as dancing, this is every afternoon at the double lunch in our high school, rock and roll music was played, and after people ate, they would go in the gym and dance. Everybody did this because, of course, we had a pretty much single ethnic group at the school, and there would be no argument as to what music to play.
All right, now that leads to a couple questions.
Yeah.
What was the ethnic group, and what years are we talking about?
Well, I was in high school about 1955 to 59, and the ethnic group was actually an umbrella Catholic group predominantly, but it consisted of a number of different European nationalities, you might say. A lot of them, well, I always used to say after I grew up, we were half Irish, half Italian, and about a quarter Polish. But there were also other people who were there. We had a chunk of Greeks and a chunk of Portuguese and a few Spanish from actual Spain and Austrians. And all of those people, however, kind of slipped in under the Italian rubric. And so they were, in other words, you were either Irish or something darker. And then you could be Polish, which was a separate group, do you see, but smaller. All of those were similarly inclined somehow. I don't know. We were all had the same taste in music, let's put it that way, and the same kind of lifestyle, I guess. In fact, the area was so Catholic that we used to have to go down to the church, which is about, I'd say a mile away. We walked, usually, except for the few who had cars in senior year, for religious instruction one afternoon a week over the lunch hour. Everybody would be excused for the double lunch. We'd eat and then have the second lunch to walk down to the church and go to religious instruction and walk back.
Now, this was part of the public school program?
Yeah, it wasn't for the program. It's just that the school accommodated religious instruction on the noon hour. But they had no direct tie with it, except if you cut religious instruction and went off driving around and hot rodding and stuff instead, the nuns would send a list of people who had skipped instruction to the high school, and the high school would compare that with people who had not been in school at all that day. And if you had cut religious instruction, you'd be called into the dean of students' office, and they'd make you stay after school. Okay, that was our version of the separation of church and state. No nuns taught in the school. No teachers taught religious instruction.
Yeah.
But there was a little bit of administrative overlap.
Sounds
back
like,
in the day.
Yeah, real collaboration.
Yes, needless to say, we also had Christmas reviews and Christmas parties and Christmas everything, you know. In the whole time that I was there, I saw one black student, and I think we had maybe one or two Jewish students, and that was about it. And they were from that other side of the tracks, that suburb of Westvale. Other than that, when we partied, we all smoked. It was the thing to smoke. I started smoking at 15 because of that. Threw up at first, got used to it. We would go out if we were not dancing to the cars and park and sit in people's parked cars and smoke at noon hour because you couldn't smoke on campus. We would always have parties every weekend, every single weekend. When I was a senior, they were usually at my house because my mother liked it better if everybody was where she knew where I was, at my house. Had a big living room, and we would play records, and we would provide, she never provided anything for us to drink. She just turned a blind eye. And we would bring in whatever we could afford, which was never very much, so nobody really got drunk, because we didn't have munificent parents providing so that their daughter would have a lot of friends attracted because of the alcohol. It didn't happen. We would buy on our way home a six-pack, or if somebody could afford it, a pint of vodka or something. And whatever we could afford and whatever we could get from our jobs after school, that was what we were allowed to have, and that was it, and then that would be gone. So that was what was considered party hardy, and I really contrast that a lot now with my grandchildren, one of whom just graduated last year from East Lansing High School, and the other one is a senior. They hardly ever party. In fact, from my point of view, they never party, never. And I look back and showing them my high school yearbook when I went to my 50th reunion in 2009, and one person after another kept saying, you know, don't party too hard in college. There was constant references to, and remember the time when we, and, you know, references to things which one guy told me in later years he crossed out because he was so embarrassed by it. I think he'd passed out and had his face written on or something. I can't remember now. But we thought that was terrific. And such was the culture that I remember, remembering now the drinking age was 18. We, a whole bunch of us, went to the Catholic college on the other side of town, Le Moyne College, which is Jesuit. For the freshman opening week, they had a big beer party. They had a kegger because, you know, there were no freshmen under 18. If there were, they didn't want to know about it. And that's the kind of thing that was typically done. It's, I don't know, I hate to call it ethnic, but I don't know any ethnic Catholic culture or sub, you know, national group that frowns on alcohol, you know, across the board, like I stereotype Protestants as doing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Never would occur to anybody that this would not be appropriate. You know, I remember Italian little kids would be given watered down wine when they were young, and the Irish and the Polish kids would always be given sips of beer. And it was just, you know,
it was
part of
their
deal.
Family culture.
Yeah. So I guess that's how that all grew up. In college, I suddenly decided to become a serious student. Really, if competition had been like it is now, with my high school record, which was not inspired because I just did what was effortless for me or I didn't do it very much, I probably wouldn't have gotten into a good college today. And as it was, the Jesuit college had very high standards, but it was small and fairly new. We all got in that wanted to. And we had two cars full that drove across town every single day to go to class. We all lived at home. And then I suddenly realized my future was at stake, and I became a Dean's List student. You see, I always could have done it, but I just didn't want to bother. In fact, I didn't get into the National Honor Society in high school, not because my grades were so bad, but because I got in a lot of trouble because I was out partying and drinking and doing things like that. The principal, though, felt he had to explain that to me and called me into his office to say why he wasn't recommending me for the National Honor Society. I had forgotten it existed. I had no interest. I was not a person who revered authority or people's opinions of me aside from actual scholars. Professors, now, yes.
Now, when you didn't go to a Catholic elementary school.
No, I went to public school.
Public schools all the way through.
Yes.
Except when you went to college.
Mm-hmm, when I went to college. And it's just that became the unspoken thing. Everybody that was in my crowd mostly went to the Catholic college. Some went to Syracuse University. One, a guy that I had dated for quite a long time because his mother worked there deliberately on purpose as a secretary because they would give free tuition to the children of employees. Uh-huh. It's a private school. They could do what they wanted, you see. And so he and his sisters both got, or three of them got free tuition. But most people went to Le Moyne, actually. Right.
Were you an only child?
No, I had a younger brother. He went very briefly to Colgate and just was not the academic type, didn't get enough out of it. So he dropped out of there and went into the police academy and then was drafted or signed up, I can't remember which, to go into the army and was sent to Vietnam for a year and came back and went into the state police. Mm-hmm. See, so that was always his sort of a thing. But I was the only academic person. When I was little, my parents had thought because I read a lot, I should be a librarian. That was how their minds worked. And I know they meant literally the head librarian at the local library. That was like Madam Librarian, you know, in The Music Maker.
Yes.
That would be what they would picture. And they didn't even imagine getting a master's degree in library science at that point. But I knew that I could go another way, especially after I had been at Le Moyne for a while. And I majored in English because, well, actually, I found out that not only did I enjoy reading and read vociferously and a lot and all the time, but people would actually pay me to do it.
What do you mean?
Well, if I became an English teacher,
I
could major in English. Uh-huh. I could do nothing but read books and write about books and talk about books for the rest of my life. I considered that a racket, actually. And so as soon as I found out that I could actually make a career out of it better than being a local high school teacher, I told the person who was teaching the required survey of English literature for English majors at college that I wanted to get a PhD. And I just assumed that I could, you know, and that I wanted it and that I would do it, and that was it. And later on, he said, you know, it took a lot of nerve to actually approach me and say that when you were a sophomore. I said, I really didn't think so. So I did methodically take about three English courses every single semester from that point on and, you know, broke them up in such a way that I wouldn't mix them up.
Yeah.
You know, one course in the 19th century novel along with Shakespeare, along with 17th century poetry, let's say. So I'd never confuse them. And I had as much literature as I could possibly take. We also had to take 16 hours of theology, which would be 2 hours each semester of the whole time we were there, and 24 hours of philosophy, which was required of everyone, and fit in our majors around that. So on top of that, I still did, of course, fit in other requirements. I had to get a Bachelor of Science degree in English literature, which sounds strange, but it was such a conservative academic school that you could only get a Bachelor of Arts if you had Latin and Greek. And everybody who'd gone to parochial schools had taken Latin, but I had never taken Latin. I just took French. So I could not get the Latin degree and take Greek while I was at Le Moyne, you see. And so they gave me the degree of Bachelor of Science in English Literature with a French specialization, which meant it paid off really well when I got here because I was allowed to teach easily ATL, which was basically American Studies with a writing component. And I had fortunately had history and sociology and economics and was able to prepare myself better than I could if I had had the Latin and the Greek and the math. That was another thing I got out of the math, another subject on which I, you know, threw away anything that I had remembered from high school, math and science. I passed them, but only by walking into each exam as if I were a full glass of water and dumping it on the page and then forgetting and walking out empty, okay? So it was a good thing that I was in social sciences, really. College was a lot more nose to the grindstone than high school had ever been. I did way less partying in high school, in college, than I did in high school. A lot of people do the reverse because Right. they're under very strict parental control in high school, whereas my friends and I were pretty much allowed freedom. And in college, they're like spring-loaded missiles that get into the freshman dorm and they're suddenly free of any oversight and they go berserk. And of course, some of them destroy themselves. But I had already put that behind me, kind of. And so I worked really, really, really hard in college. In the summers, I would go up to the Adirondack Mountains and work as a waitress. And then I would make up for the year because we would be out partying just about every single night. There would be very few nights we would miss. Most of the waitresses would work either a day shift or an evening shift, but they would finish serving dinner no later than, say, 10 o'clock at night, go home and take a nap or rest, wait for the bartenders to close up at 2, restock the bars, and then we'd all go out, eat breakfast at an all-night place, and then go to a party until dawn.
I see you're smiling as you remember that.
Oh, yes. Yes. Those were very good times. I had one of the summers, I had a cousin was up there, too. He was a counselor at a woodcraft camp, an Adirondack woodcraft camp near Inlet and Racket Lake, New York, or near Inlet, not as close to Racket Lake. At the end of the summer, he had to spend 3 days in the infirmary resting up. He never had enough sleep the whole time because he was not on shifts. He had to be up every day early with the campers. And see, waitresses could get back at dawn and sleep until noon before they had to go back to work again.
Yeah.
So that was the way it was, though. It was definitely a daily party up there. So I lived through that somehow. And also after school in the rest of the academic year through high school and college, I worked at a women's fashion shop, a specialty store kind of thing. One place only, in other words, not a chain. I got the job at 14, largely because somebody who was in the high school was told to look for somebody who could become a little stock girl, you know, ironing things to be put out on the racks. And this girl knew that I had been in the store a number of times with my mother, asked me if I'd like to be the stock girl at Van Ness Fashions, and I said yes. They hired me, and I never left until I graduated from college. I would work after school and in college Friday nights and Saturdays, basically, right until I was, you know, out of high school or college and had a bachelor's degree, and then went to California for graduate school.
Where in California did you?
Stanford.
Why?
Well, I had a choice of the two best schools, and I applied to lots of them under the National Defense Act, which was big at that time. And also, I had my interview for a Woodrow Wilson, but I didn't know if I would get it. So I had a lot of schools that had National Defense, plus my two good schools were Cornell and Stanford. And I did get the Woodrow Wilson, and I could take it anywhere I wanted. Cornell accepted me, and Stanford accepted me. And I said, I've lived all my life an hour and a half away from Ithaca. I'd like to get away from upstate New York. And so only because Stanford accepted me and I wanted to leave town, I went to Stanford. And it seems extravagant, you know, when you could just go down to Ithaca to go instead all the way out to California. But I loved it. It was a big adventure. I went by Greyhound bus unless I could get a ride home or part of the way home with people from there and in later semesters and stuff. But I went out to Stanford and I loved Stanford. Everybody loved Stanford, in fact. I didn't want to leave after 4 years. Like everybody else, I offered myself to every little junior college just as a way of staying in upstate California in the Bay Area. But they were overloaded with the highest quality faculty you could imagine of people who'd gone to Berkeley and Stanford and didn't want to leave. Yes. So they didn't need me. and I got the job at Michigan State.
So this was your first job?
Oh, yes, right out of graduate school.
Did you do any teaching as a graduate student?
Yes, I did. After 1 year, most of us were offered a teaching assistantship. And so I think everybody who didn't flunk out was offered a teaching assistantship, in fact, because they had tiny classes, and that which was very, very good for the freshmen. I think we had under 20 students. And so every graduate student would get one. And so I had my one for 3 years. Mm. See? And so I did that amount of teaching, which was very good, very exhausting.
Yes,
I didn't realize
it. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I did enjoy it at first. It was very tiring. One professor told me, "You are going to be so tired." And I thought, it's silly. How could I be tired teaching something that's not intellectually challenging like freshman English? But it is the talking. It is being on like a disc jockey that can't shut up, that, you know, you're not accustomed to in seminars or as a grad student. And so I really was tired out just from the strain of having to keep the show on the road during the class time, which I'd never had to do before. But at the same time, it was a shot in the arm, because after being very high-powered through 4 years of college and getting my cum laude degree and my Woodrow Wilson, I kind of had a slump. And in the first year of graduate school, I knew why I was there, and I worked, of course. But I kind of lost perspective on my long-range career by then. It had been so long, fifth year in, you know. But getting a class renewed my commitment and gave me an idea, you see, of what it will be like when you finally get your degree. And so that motivated me to keep going, even though it was extra work.
That's
it also helped a lot. It was a very good thing for me to have a class and plan a class and to get a feeling of what it was going to be like. So I very much enjoyed teaching my one class every semester for 3 years. And then when it came time to leave, of course, everybody was sending out feelers. Jobs were still pretty good. This was 1967 by now, because I went to college, remember, 59 through 63. And then 63 through 67, graduate school. It was the height of the Vietnam War, height of protests, and there were still, though, boom times. We hadn't yet suffered from blowing all the money that we did in Vietnam at home. We were suffering in the inner cities. The poverty program of Lyndon B. Johnson suffered, but they hadn't yet hit programs at universities, and enrollment hadn't started yet to drop. And the baby boomers were still all in school. So there were lots of jobs to be had and lots of people looking for jobs. I was looking for a job as what we used to call an ABD, all but dissertation. Today you couldn't get one. But at that time you could if you had a good address. And we were reminded we had a good address at Stanford. So I wrote to a lot of different places, and so did everybody else. And I also went to the Modern Language Association conference that December in New York, as did many other people. And there I interviewed a number of schools, including Michigan State. And when I looked over, you know, where I got offers, where I was asked to come for interviews, the place that offered me the best package was Michigan State.
Oh, that's interesting.
Other places were either smaller or had a bad rep, like, you know, schools I maybe shouldn't mention, but I will mention one, University of Chicago. I was told I had a reputation for having what they called a revolving bottom, that they would take you in and then throw you back out and then get somebody else in and throw them out. And so that you really had a very, very, very tiny chance of becoming a tenured professor if you started out as an assistant professor. There were various schools like that that might seem attractive until you realized what they actually would do. Michigan State didn't have that reputation. And so I put the package together, and I looked at the way other schools that I had had offers at struck me. Michigan State was the biggest. It seemed the most secure because of the size of it, because it seemed like they wouldn't run out of money or have to cut people soon or anything like that. I was looking, you know, for security in part. And so I actually said to people when I decided, because I was reluctant a little bit, I thought of Michigan as a place where there was nothing but Big Ten football and corn. And I hadn't even thought of Detroit. But if I did, it still wouldn't be an intellectual aspect, you see, of the Big Ten. I had kind of looked down on the Big Ten in a little way, but at the same time, I looked up to the size and prestige of the university and its security as I saw it. And I said, if you got to be a whore, pick a good hotel. So that's why I came here.
Michigan State was a good hotel.
A good hotel.
And you didn't even have to be a whore.
No, you didn't. And they took me as an ABD. Ultimately, I did finish my dissertation and got tenure and all the rest. It took a while because when I first got here, I was kind of like caught up in teaching. And again, I had a slump, I think, of once I got here, I lost the drive to finish my dissertation. And I'd done everything else, so I had only that literally left to do. But instead, I got married and I had a child. And it was actually in 72, when I'd been here a while already, it was getting toward the end of the time the AAUP would want me to be evaluated, that I was had been home in the summer, having had a child in June of 72. In the summer of 72, I was signing back up, you know, and filling papers out and ordering books for the fall. And I opened my mail. I found I'd gotten a raise. And I thought, this is a racket. There's no place else I could have done so little in the past year and still have gotten a raise. I have to stay with this. I'm going to finish my dissertation. So I did. Again, I was thinking back to how there's no way else I could just read books and talk about books. I forgot at the time how much it would wear me down to grade papers over 40 years, which it did. The worst of it, in fact, was for grading papers. But I thought, this is the best way, really, that I could have my life. If it were just me I was responsible for, I remember saying I could be a cocktail waitress and to get myself enough money to live. But now that I have a child to be responsible for, and I've already got this niche, I'm going to keep it. So I finished my dissertation. You see, it was always a matter of deciding to do it. I would slump on motivation at a couple of points, as you can see.
Right, yeah. What did you do your dissertation on?
Who? Flannery O'Connor.
Oh.
She's, of course, as most people know, an Irish Catholic writer from Georgia. And very, very intense, what they call Southern Gothic. Very kind of obsessed with the role of Christ in people's lives. Seeing people who were not devout, but rather materialistic and egoistic as people who were deformed. She saw them as grotesques. And that was the way in which she used grotesquerie in her writing. I thought she was fascinating. And so I had already come across her, of course, in my readings. And when I realized I needed a dissertation topic and one that had not been mined to death, I thought about her. And conveniently for me, cold-blooded though it sounds, she died in 1964. Mm-hmm. And generally, you know, universities frown upon people writing on a living person because their body is not complete, their corpus of work. So there she was, ready to go, and almost nobody had written anything on her. So I had virgin territory to go to work on, and I had had many classes in close analysis of text and in what they used to call the New Criticism back in the day, from someone who, in fact, had studied under Father Walter Ong at St. Louis University. And then when I got to Stanford, I worked with Wallace Stegner, who did a lot of work on the short story. I did a couple of courses with him. And so I did a lot of very close examination of the texts of her stories, comparing her first and her second collections, essentially, in terms of their emphasis, and found that they broadened in their scope, as a lot of people did in their own personal scope, from a stress on individuals and how they relate to humanity or to God, to their own integrity, to their own ethics, to their own spiritual, say, righteousness, over to the same kind of attitude but expressed in terms of how you saw society. The second collection of her books was post-civil rights movement. And now she talked about how people's attitudes were reflected in their approach to society, in their approach to race especially, even though people still adjudged her personally to be not enlightened enough to escape the label of racism. But she was trying. And she was very self-aware of people who were trying too hard, like her, but were still trapped in more or less racist attitudes they couldn't escape. You know, she had a character, for example, who used to revel in being more liberal than his mother and wishing he could have his mother be really sick and in extremis and bring her the only doctor available who would be a black doctor, by God, but realizing that in itself was not the most enlightened attitude to have. Okay, so there was a difference in her attitude as it developed toward what constituted religiosity and what constituted an expression of religious attitude and orientation toward other people, and became much more oriented from making a little garden of your heart into Matthew 25, as you have done unto the least of these, my brethren, so you have done unto me, which is what most liberals cite if they're Christians as the basis of their outgoing, you know,
involvement
desire.
In society.
Yes, their involvement, their engagement with social issues. So I chose her and worked on her very steadily and got it finished, never got it published, but I got it cited many times, I found, in other people's dissertations, other people's work.
Good.
And went on to do some work in her and some work in other things that I had always been interested in. I got into popular culture and joined the Popular Culture Association, liked it better than the Modern Language Association. And so in there I indulged interests that I had had since I was a young kid in vampires. And that led me into writing about vampires and some other science fiction, and especially into Anne Rice and her vampire novels and her novels about witches in New Orleans. And I ended up becoming the Anne Rice chair, in fact, at the Popular Culture Association while she was at her peak of popularity. Now, of course, she's stopped writing that kind of thing and gone into very poorly written religious writing now, kind of. Well, she did briefly. Mm-hmm. She,
I think she's rejected that, too.
She has. Yes, she has. She was an atheist writing these really engaging vampire and witch novels. And then she went back to the Catholic Church, but only for a couple of years because she decided they were homophobic and anti-female. And then she gave up not just the Catholic Church, but every religious institution, and now doesn't write any Jesus books anymore. But she wrote a couple of those, which were not very good.
So what you're telling me, in effect, is that your work at Michigan State gave you the very opportunity that you were looking for in life.
Oh, I think so.
Namely, to explore literature, write on literature, and it was absolutely the right choice for you.
Oh, I think so. I never have regretted choosing Michigan State. Another thing that I did, which was one of the key things at Michigan State, was that from, about 1967 or 8, not long after I got here, I think it was within a year, by 1969, there was a lot of pressure from African-American students, who were always called black students then, to add more material about black students, about black people, into the existing ATL curriculum. And that was also one of my interests, the civil rights movement and everything. So I helped to create the first, what they called, Minorities in America track as part of the old ATL, and then change that over when we reconditioned and reshaped all the classes into the ethnic identity in America. And I really taught those classes for the whole time that I was at Michigan State, from like 69 right on through. And then in about 1992, when we branched off and developed the CIS, Center for Integrative Studies, I did the arts and humanities classes, and I designed one in particular which would incorporate material from the movement, the civil rights movement, and the 60s. By 92, these were past history, and we could now, veterans of the 60s, talk about them and teach about them. So I created a class called the 60s, in which I did three strands of the braid from the 60s, the civil rights movement, Vietnam, and popular culture movement. And these things, you know, played right into everything else that I had always been doing, except vampires, but my interest in rock and roll, my interest in the civil rights movement, and of course my having actually lived through the 60s. I had original sources, primary sources, that probably almost nobody else had. Today, this course is being taught by people who've heard about the 60s, but almost everybody's retired now, and it's a different world completely and a different kind of class altogether. In this time also, while I was at Michigan State, I met the very first semester I was here, my husband-to-be, and a lot of friends that I still have after all that time, who were friends of his in the history department and friends of mine in ATL. And I married a history professor who was an African-American, Les Rout, Leslie B. Rout Jr., okay, in 1969. And so that, of course, was one of the things that was a major part of my life, that and our two children. Deirdre was born in June of 72, and Leslie Brennan Rout III, who was born in December of 77. And that was my marriage until 1987, when my husband died in April. And so I've been a widow since that time. But fortunately, as I said then, and I still say, when I was widowed, at least I had friends and tenure. Both of these were extremely important, you know. And I even lectured some of my friends who had not worked or who had not gotten degrees, because one of the things always in my mind was the fact that my father had died when I was in high school. My mother was lucky to be able to have a master's degree and go back and teach. In my mind, always, I knew that in spite of my slumps and my ups and downs in pursuing career and degrees, I would do it. Because I always imagined myself setting myself up, thinking I'd be secure as a faculty wife, for example, and having two or maybe three kids, and then being divorced or widowed. And then if I were an English major with no advanced degree, I would, what did I do, be a secretary, try to get a job as a social worker? I lectured a lot of people about this in later years, including all my students. You know, that you never know what's going to happen and you should always cover yourself. And I was covered as it happened. You know, when I was suddenly widowed, I had a 9-year-old and a 14-year-old. And I had tenure at the university. All I had to do was to get a jump to kind of get myself reoriented to the workload of a single parent. And I was able to pick up and carry on and take care of my kids. It was one of the things that made it difficult at that time, I now recall, was that our chairman was in the throes of fights with the dean and fights with the department and ended up over in the history department at the end of it all, was barely able to process the fact that I had been abruptly widowed and that my husband had died very suddenly. And he made no provision for me to have the semester off. My husband had died in April, the 2nd of April, and it was right at the beginning of the spring quarter.
Quarter.
We had quarters back in those days.
Quarter system,
yes,
then.
Going until June. And no provision was made for me to get the quarter off, which I should have had, really.
Absolutely.
But like happens when you have serious things occur, as I was just discussing with you, my fire and people's car accidents and things, you don't think straight and you can't really pull back and assess the situation and you initiate what people should be doing for you. This is not easy to do. And nobody else had said either to him, Henry, she should have the semester off. This is, 100 on the scale of 1 to 100 of things that people have to be dealing with that is stressful. Loss of a spouse is right up there. And so I had 2 weeks in which a friend took my classes, Pat Julius, and did it for no extra pay, of course. I felt guilty about that. I don't know why. I didn't blame him, but I blamed myself. And a couple of other people graded papers for me, but nothing else was done. In fact, getting close to the end of the 2 weeks, he called me and said, when are you going to be coming back? I want you to chair the appointments committee. I said, Henry, I can't chair the appointments committee. It'll be way too much work. All those interviews, all those applications to go over. Oh, no, he said it won't be too much work. You can do it. I said, maybe I will. And then I thought about it, and I said, I can't. So I wrote him a letter saying, no, I cannot do it. I quit and from the committee. And so I went, and I still had to teach three classes. And that did create, however, a whole new way of doing the research paper, which we always did in the spring semester. I knew I couldn't read 90 research papers. There was no way in the world. So I created a system that I must have been in the back of my mind before, an easy way of doing it for me, which was that students would submit first a bibliography, then come in and talk with me at the halfway point about the reading they were doing and how they were coming along with their topic, and at the end, submit only an outline, a detailed outline that I didn't have to read in every detail. Because even if you know half of something has been plagiarized and cut and pasted, you still have to be able to read it to be able to defend a grade of a 2-point versus a 3-point versus a 4-point if necessary. You have to be able to assess it. And I found I could assess a detailed outline just as well. And so that was the system I used from that time on, from 1987 until I retired. Okay, so that was a very big, you know, time, I would say, both academically and personally. Things really became very different after that as a single parent with two kids and, of course, one of them beginning high school with the usual teenage issues. And I found that it was very challenging to be the mother of a teenager and also the father of a 9-year-old boy. I didn't do a good father, as a couple of other women who've been single parents have also said to me. Oh. It's hard to be a father. And, you know, it took really about, I guess, all the energy that I had, basically. I did a lot of papers at conferences in those years. It was the only traveling I ever did anymore. I got a lot of papers written, but really only one book. I had to write a book to become a full professor. And so I used the interests I already had, and I wrote a book on Eldridge Cleaver, who was the Black Panther Party Minister of Information. And I developed that into a book in 1990 so that I could get my promotion to full professor finally. And that, of course, was the only book I ever actually did, although I did a lot of articles and papers at conferences and things like that. Previously, I had traveled other places, including once to South America with my husband when our daughter was 20 months old. His field was Latin American history. And so we went to Venezuela and Brazil and Argentina, which was not easy with a kid in diapers, I can tell you that. We washed out diapers in the toilets and hung them out the windows. You couldn't get anything like Pampers in South America, because everyone had maids and everyone had very cheap labor. And so there was no reason for anybody to buy disposable diapers. You simply couldn't get any such thing. One place, I can't remember, it might have been Argentina, we found something which was kind of like a big Kotex that was held on with a plastic panty, and that was what was used for a diaper. We didn't do that much. It was really not worth it. So that was a stressful trip, but that was the only time really that I traveled after I had children at all, until we got a cottage. And when we got a cottage, it was a relief from traveling. You know, we'd gone with the 20-month-old to South America. We'd gone to maybe Chicago and Toronto and places like that, but it was very difficult. You'd have to go everywhere you went, visiting relatives or home to see my mother, with a crib and a high chair, or if they'd have to have one there set up. We had everything, porta-crib, porta-seat, porta-everything. And not only that, but I began to realize when you traveled with a kid, you had the inconvenience, but also whenever you go away, even for the weekend, I said, you know, we're spending about $1,000 every time we go on vacation. Wouldn't it be nice to have a cottage? And I had grown up with a family cottage from my mother's side of the family in the Adirondack Mountains, up about where I went to work later on in college. But I didn't stay there, of course. It had already been sold. But I was used to having a place in the Adirondacks to go to, and I knew people had places farther north in Michigan. My husband was from the south side of Chicago. He'd never even seen a cottage, as far as I know. He had no idea what you'd do at one. He didn't like to swim. He couldn't see why you would bother, and he was not sympathetic. And so what I sold him on was not only will we save money and not have to spend $1,000 every time we go to vacation anymore, but we will build equity. Wouldn't you like to build equity? Oh boy, would he like to build equity. So when he was at the Smithsonian for a semester as a Woodrow Wilson scholar, I took that time to look up different places where I could get a cottage not too far away. I knew he would never consent to drive all the way to the Upper Peninsula. But I found one in Crystal, Michigan, which is north and then west, not far past Carson City, right at Crystal Lake, not the famous one, but the smaller one, which is about 5 to 7 miles around and big enough so it has a sandy bottom rather than a mucky bottom and perfectly acceptable. It's got sailboats, everything, but you can get there in an hour and 10 minutes. That I knew he would go for. So I practically signed the papers without him. I think I did wait till he got back for a break or something for Memorial Day and take him up there and show it to him. And I'd taken a builder friend up and he said, it's not going to fall down. Don't worry about it. It was built in batches, you know, in the Depression and the 20s and then the Depression, et cetera. So we bought it. $19,900 furnished. Imagine 57 feet of lakefront, 200 feet straight back, backyard to play frisbee in and everything. Couldn't believe it at this time. You could never imagine it.
Do you still have it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's in the second generation now, and it will go down to the third. Okay. Other people up there are on to their fifth or more. Some families have just been there forever. But that we never, absolutely never regretted. And the first year was work, 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 work. The reason I got it so cheap was that it was very dilapidated. And I found out about it because I was actually taking auditing a class in Portuguese after having been to Brazil. I thought that would be something I'd like to learn. In that class, I met a guy who was from Crystal. It only has a population of about 300, and one of them was a student at Michigan State taking a Portuguese class that I was in. So I mentioned this looking for a place, and he said, after he came back from Memorial Day, that was, you know, there's a place for sale up on Crystal right on the waterfront, and I can't believe it. I didn't know this guy ever had a place on the lake, but he's let it go so disastrously that the school teacher that used to rent it every July and August has refused to rent it anymore unless he'll fix it up, and he's so lazy he won't fix it up. He'd rather sell it. I said, let me take a look. So he gave me the address, and I went up, and it needed work. But it needed work that you could hire somebody to do.
Exactly.
It was, well, not all of it. I take that back. Some of it we did do to save even the construction. It needed a lot of work, especially with siding and other things. But we bought it cheap. And then the whole front porch, 18 feet long, the windows were all rotting right in their sills because they caught strong wind right off the lake. The wood was rotten in the front because of the same winds and had to be ripped out and replaced with plywood in order to put up siding. My husband and his then graduate student, John Bratzel, who's now still in ATL at RAC and Latin American Studies, I believe, pulled out the windows. They actually pulled them out, and they swore that the glass would bend. It was so old. They pulled out all those windows, and when we had the siding put in, those were replaced with combination storm screen aluminum, and siding was put on, and we had the whole back porch torn off, the back door torn off and thrown away, and all replaced by builders. A ceiling dropped because there'd never been a ceiling. And then a friend of my husband's that he'd known for many years in Chicago was at the time a Martin Sanur paint dealer. And he got us 23 gallons of paint. We got outdoor paint so we could use it everywhere. And we painted the trim and the whole inside of the porch and all the chairs and all the woodwork and everything we could paint inside that house. We went through 23 gallons of paint. And that took care of it. We replaced the rugs in the bedrooms, which were other people's old, musty dining room rugs or something, with wall-to-wall. Actually, it wasn't. It was not wall-to-wall. It turned out to be wall-to-wall carpeting from Sears. And it's been our spot ever since, you know.
So you go there during the summer.
Yes, we go there during the summer. And it was the place where our kids really grew up. My daughter was four when we got it, and our son hadn't been born yet. That first summer was a lot of work. So when we finally had this, our son could bring him up at 6 months old in the spring, summer of 78, that would be. So it was really the second summer. We had no more work to do. And finally, after all that work, which my husband grumbled through, he was lying on the sofa or the swing in the porch, drinking a beer and listening to the baseball game. No telephone, so the department couldn't call him. He said, "Now," he said, "I see why people have cottages, finally." Okay, aside from building equity. So it's been our spot ever since.
Yep. Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. So would you say, all these things you tell me about, except for your husband's death, were high points?
Oh, yeah. I think I've had a lot of high points. I think thinking back, it was extremely fortunate that I ended up at Michigan State. It was a good hotel. And one of the good things about it that I fear is not going to be around for people in the future is the security of tenure. And also, I don't know, I shouldn't say that they won't do it, but I'm not sure what the contributions will be to TIAA CREF in the future. Always through the years, as you're well aware, we contributed 5% of our pay to TIAA CREF, and the university matched that with 10. That was unusual. Some people had theirs matched with 1% or even 5 and 5, and we only had the 10%, really making it 15% of our pay. I think as an unusual fluke, some people say because of the influence of the UAW in Michigan that pushed all institutions toward greater human resources responsibility. But we were very, very fortunate in that. And it meant that actually Michigan State contributed more than I did. I contributed additional in an SRA, a supplemental, on my own that, of course, was not matched. But still, the contribution of Michigan State was significant and made a tremendous difference over the years in how much I had to retire on when I finally did. And of course, it benefited all of us to have had the big run-up in the stock market in the 90s as well, because our money had been piling in there since the 70s, really.
That is, if you took the stock option.
Oh, yes. Well, I took the stock option largely stock. I think mine was split, 50-50 maybe, and I moved mine over all the way to stock. And when it started looking good, I just went completely to stock until I retired. Then I didn't keep that. But I went all the way to stock, and my husband had not done that. Like you and like a lot of people who were a little older and came up during the Depression, he went to TIAA because it seemed safer. As a result, he didn't have that much money when I inherited it, you know, compared to what I had. When I retired in 2005, I was going to say 92, that's when I started IAH. But the run-up in the 60s, in the 90s, in the stock market really made it possible. Yeah. And then also what helped, frankly, was I finally got cautious. In 2002, there began the big decline. Actually, it had just barely started in 2001, but after 9/11, it took a nosedive, the stock market. In 2002, I remember, I think that was the year when Greenspan said, there is irrational exuberance in the stock market. And I said, if he says it, he knows it. And I went and took almost all my money out of the stock market and put it in bonds. CREF bonds instead.
In TIAA.
And in TIAA. Not just TIAA, there's a CREF bond.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yes.
That.
So I took it from CREF stock and put it into CREF bond because that's still flexible. Once you move into TIAA, you can't get it out so easy. And I did that right before the really big nosedive happened.
You were lucky.
So some people lost 50% of everything they had.
That's right.
And I lost almost nothing because the bond market went up. The stock that I did leave in there went down a little bit, so I did lose. And I, of course, I had other stock accounts that I had invested in. Those took a dive, too.
Yeah,
so I was hit on all of those.
Yeah.
But still, I was secure enough, I felt, when I assessed things. Maybe it was a little rash, but I assessed things in 2002. I turned 60. And I said, now, do I want to do this for 5 more years or not? And I thought, you know, I just don't think I can stand it for 5 more years. Mm-hmm. It really, really gets to you teaching freshmen As they used to say, a lot of people would say, when you can't stand the stupidity of the freshman anymore, you have to quit. And it was just the blank stares get to me after a while. I just, the constantly asking questions, no feedback, blank looks, 5 out of every 30 kids prepared for class in any decent way. It wears you down and you just get overly bored, and the burden of grading papers gets greater and greater all the time. And I looked at it and I said, I'd like to get out in 3 years. I can do it. And so I just made the decision, and I knew it would be a big decision because I don't make breaks easily. So I signed it on. I signed all the papers in 2002 to retire in 2005. I got the guarantees that I could, you know, as to not getting the smallest possible raise at least, and other things, take my computer home and, you know, things like that. And I went ahead and signed on to do it so that I would have a date when I would know would be the final date, and I could gradually work my mind up to it. And that was what I actually did. I kind of gradually changed my hours and my way of operating. I finally joined the university club, which I had never belonged to before in that year, and you know, began to adjust the best that I could. But still, it was a big, big jump. I still felt like I had signed my death sentence in a way.
But you don't regret that decision?
No, no, not in retrospect at all, because I found out there is life after retirement, and it is easier life. But I would sit in my office, and I would look at all my books, and I would think, these will all be gone. I'll be out of here. Somebody else will be in this office, and it will be as if I never existed. And that really kind of impressed me. It's like I was, you know, making a decision to obliterate myself, kind of. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough to say, oh, the students you taught still exist out there in the world. You know, that's not the point. I was talking about my actual presence. But I gradually just phased myself out of it and worked down to where I was teaching 2 days a week and showing up 3 days a week. I would teach Tuesdays, Thursdays, show up Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, take off Mondays and Fridays, start to move out and have other interests. As it happened, my daughter was planning on moving back here at the same time.
Moving back here from where?
England. Yes, she had moved there right after she graduated from high school and had gone to school first to become a midwife and then became a doctor, had 2 marriages and 4 children all by this time. And she moved back here in 06, the year after I retired. Fortunately for me that I was retired, because it began to take a lot of my time. But I was able to see myself doing that. One thing that did help was that when I was retiring at technically 62, but I taught the summer, one last summer, so I was really 63, turned 63 in July, I was able to draw on my husband's Social Security as a widow and leave my own to mature until my full retirement age of what was then 65 years and 10 months and not touch it. So that even though I wasn't continuing to add to it for those couple of years, I could let it mature. And so I drew as a widow, and I still got Social Security without interfering with my own, you see, and that helped.
Oh, sure.
And I started the TIAA CREF. I already, of course, had my husband's TIAA CREF. So I get now 4 checks from them, technically. And I had to, of course, drop my husband's Social Security. You don't get to double dip on that. Mm-hmm. But when it came time for me to switch to my own, of course, I would make more money because I had taught longer years than he did. So now I'm on my own. But that made the bridge easier also.
Wow.
So I was definitely able to make that jump. And even though the 08 dive was unforeseen, and it did cause all of us to take a hit in our TIAA CREF paybacks and everything, it's now starting to recover. And I just took that philosophically. I decided I never could have foretold, even in 05, you know, that in 08 this would dive like this.
No.
So I just decided, well, there was nothing to do about it. I would just, you know, drop back and punt.
Do you have any relationship with Michigan State now since retirement?
Well, I donate still. I am a donor to a number of places. I've donated to the library a lot of books, some to special collections. And I've donated to the American Studies program before they cut that out. I donated books to them. I've donated a huge number of books from my research to the African American and African Studies program in Arts and Letters. I had done a lot of research not only on Eldridge Cleaver, but on Huey Newton, who was the co-founder with Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party. And had been preparing a manuscript and going to write a book on Huey Newton, but got bogged down, and so I didn't finish it. But I still had all that material, including even a copy of Huey Newton's dissertation. He got a PhD from the University of California at Santa Cruz, which a lot of people don't know. Tons and tons of notes that I took at both the Cleaver Collection at Berkeley and the Newton Collection at Stanford in two separate times when I went out to California on research trips for a week at a time. And I knew that there'd be no graduate students now getting research money to go out and take trips like that anymore. And so the students in the African American and African Studies were thrilled. They came personally to the house and helped pack up all those. I think I had 12 boxes of books and papers, Xeroxed materials from the collections, you see, at Berkeley and Stanford, and tons of books and tons of notes that I'd taken on books, and, you know, my own, one copy of my own book, and all that stuff. I donated that. And then my husband had been a jazz musician in addition to his work in history. He had been a European history, or I guess generic history major, as an undergraduate. But he'd also, all those years since he was in high school, played baritone sax. He also had a soprano sax. But he mostly played baritone. And in college, he had been part of the Paul Winter Quintet. And the Paul Winter Quintet had won the Notre Dame Intercollegiate Jazz Competition in, I think it was 1965. I'll be slaughtered for not knowing that correctly. 65, I think it was, or 66. And Paul Winter finagled with the State Department for them to be sent on a State Department sponsored trip for a full year after that as ambassadors of jazz. Going there made him want to become a specialist in Latin American history. So he went back, went to graduate school to University of Minnesota, and got his doctorate in Latin American history as a result. But he still kept playing gigs all around Michigan and taught jazz even in Chicago. He went to the University of Chicago and flew down once a week for a while and taught a class and flew back. And so when he retired, and they had already by then, you know, they hadn't yet by then, I should say, started the jazz studies program. But years later, when they did, the drummer that he always most preferred to work with, Randy Gillespie, was a part of the Professors of Jazz. So I contacted Rodney Whitaker, and I asked if they would be interested in my husband's baritone sax that was the same one he had won as best baritone sax player at that Notre Dame competition back in 65. He'd kept it all those years, and he'd played it. And I got that assessed, and I donated that to the Jazz Studies Archives. So that was actually quite a big chunk, because it turned out to be considered very valuable. And so that was a major item of donation too. I don't belong to any organizations, and I don't volunteer. Personally, I consider volunteering kind of scab work, because I know that it's very difficult for assistant professors to get teaching jobs, and I think any teaching that we do as retirees just takes a job away from somebody who is an assistant professor who would like to have one. So I kind of decline to do that. I might maybe do summer grading or something for placement, but that's about as far as I would go, and I have never done that. So I do continue to show up at things like retirees' luncheons, and I do continue to donate, and I do show up on occasion and say hello to people, but that's about the extent of it anymore.
So that sounds very good. Do you have any plans for the future?
Well, actually, I'm so busy right now that I think this is going to be my future for the moment. My grandchildren are still 18, 17, and 10. 10-year-old twins. Their mother is a single mother who is a doctor and a paramedic. And that means that she has irregular hours. And I very frequently, even now, have to take the twins to school in the morning, pick them up in the afternoon, stay overnight so that I can be there at 7 o'clock in the morning because my daughter has had to leave. Just a week or so ago, she went with her daughter on a trip down to Washington and Lee University, where her daughter was accepted and given a generous scholarship for the fall. And they wanted to have a welcome freshman day down there, and they flew down for that. Well, that meant 3 days I had to stay at her house, take the twins to school in the morning, feed the three guys, them and their older brother of 18, every evening, and pick everybody up from school, take my grandson, who's 18, to his driving test, you know, all those things. I'm very much involved in all of that, and very needed, in fact. Not to mention that, well, not ordinarily do I have so much around my own house, but I do have two houses to take care of with the cottage. Incessant work at the cottage every summer with things that need to be done. But I had a fire a couple of months ago in my own house, an electric mattress pad. Lost the entire upstairs. It would have been the house if I hadn't awakened in time. It was in my bed with me. If I hadn't jumped up and called 911 right away and gotten out of the house, it would have been the house and not just the upstairs. It was incredible the way that fire took off. I think mattresses must be made of the most flammable materials on earth, but it took all my clothes and most of my books either with that or the water damage from the firemen. I had the entire upstairs as kind of a huge suite. It had been a Cape Cod, you know, where you have windows at each end, you can see straight through. And we had knocked out the back wall and put a big master bedroom and under it a family room. And so I just took the whole master bedroom, or my husband and I did in 1979 when we built the addition. And that became sort of like a huge suite with all our books and all our clothes, and lost almost everything. The list of claims sheets is endless. You can't believe it. I'm still not finished submitting it. That has taken more time than you can imagine. I'm still not back into the entire house. They're still rebuilding the upstairs, and we have a walled-off portion that with a zip wall in it where we can go around the entryway so the workers can carry things in the front door and up the stairs to the upstairs to work. And we're living, my son, who's back from graduate school at Duquesne, is back now. He's in his room downstairs, and I'm at what used to be the master bedroom downstairs. And we just have those two bedrooms, the downstairs bath, the family room, and the kitchen, and that's all we have. And we're living in it. And the stuff in the boxes is almost impossible to count. And there's way more contents at one of the companies that was helping do the cleanup that they can't bring back until I finish the upstairs so I can put it somewhere. It's unbelievable. So at the moment that I can foresee, this is going to take me close to a year to get things back into shape. I really think so. Even though I'm technically back in the house, I lived at my daughter's for 6 weeks. Fortunately, my son was away at grad school, so he didn't have to find a place to live because it would have been extremely crowded to have to fit him in. He would have had to sleep on the sofa.
And I note that when you retired, you stayed in East Lansing.
Yes.
And you never had any thought of leaving to retire elsewhere.
No, the only reason I think anybody would want to retire is to get away from the winters. Those are a detriment. But, you know, when you're retired, you don't have to go out at all if you don't want to. So that's what I did a few days last winter. And otherwise, it's the people that I've known. People like, say, yourself, that I've known close to 40 years and some longer. And I have a circle of friends now, people that I can go to lunches with and dinners with and to the theater with and to concerts with, and I take trips with to Chicago or elsewhere. And these are people that I have many, many things in common with going back years and years, and very easy relationships because they're based on such familiarity. We've all known our children since all of our children were newborns, practically. And so there's a familiarity there now onto the third generation where we know all of our grandchildren now, each other's. And so I couldn't trade that for anything. What would I do? Show up as a single woman in some retirement community where there were a lot of couples that played golf, and I don't play golf, and I don't play bridge, and I don't like those kinds of activities, and I would feel extremely isolated. Where would I go to concerts? Where would I go to the theater? I don't want to have a golf course instead. And so if I retired, I would do, in fact, what a lot of people who never lived near a university community are doing, and that is retire near a university where there are all kinds of activities that you can do. And so I think it's ideal to have the Wharton Center and the planetarium, everything right down the road, compared to a big city where you'd have all those amenities but couldn't find a place to park to save your life and where you'd have a high crime rate. I think there couldn't be a better place to live than around here or some other major university in a similar situation. If I had had ties to Cornell, I'd be living around Cornell. I can believe that. I would have no reason to leave. People that don't have that kind of facility, I think, really flounder. And true, I've never been away from a university, really, you know, since I started as a freshman at 17 years old. And I don't ever want to be. It seems to me it's the core of everything, is the intellectual life of the whole country.
So it's been a good life.
It has.
Is there anything that we didn't cover that you would like to?
I cannot think of anything right offhand that would be major that I haven't at least brought up, you know. I think I've covered just about everything I can think of. I found that, of course, along with an awful lot of other academics, I found my politics have been pretty liberal Democrat, as have most. And that's something that I've had in common with people who have been from different departments, different religious groups from myself. I've always been active in the Catholic Church, and I've always gone, not always, most of the time gone to St. John's Student Parish. During the time our kids were in parochial school, I did go to St. Thomas Aquinas. Now they, of course, are one parish. They've been joined together, but they didn't used to be. And if you went to St. Thomas, they would give you a cheaper tuition at the parochial school. Oh. So we switched during that time so that our weekly tithe, it isn't literally a tithe, but our weekly money would go into St. Thomas's basket. Then, of course, right after the second one graduated from eighth grade in St. Thomas Aquinas, I said to him, would you mind if we went back to St. John's? He said, no, we've been back at St. John's, which is where I got married in the first place. That's where I had been attending along with my husband when we both first got here. That's where I got married in November of 1969. I think you were there. And I stayed there through the baptism of my daughter and had the baptism of my son by the second child. Of course, we were at St. Thomas, so he was at St. Thomas Aquinas. My daughter then was in kindergarten, so we'd switched. So, yes, up until it was time for kids, for her to go to kindergarten, we stayed at St. John's, and now we're back there again.
I'll just one final question I'll ask you. Your daughter came back to East Lansing to
live. Yes, she did. Yes.
Is she satisfied with her choice?
Partly. She has always been in a difficult situation regarding her attraction to and loyalty to the place where she grew up, kind of, and her desire for a much more sophisticated lifestyle where she lived in London or suburbs of London. And she left London partly because it was very difficult to survive as a single parent there. And she knew if she came back here, she would have me and she'd have her kids, I think was one of them, able to go to her high school. And she'd have some of her old friends back and everything. And she'd have a much easier time getting around. In England, all the roads are small, narrow roads, which I think were made for carriages. And now they let cars park sometimes on both sides, it seems. And cars coming have to squeeze their way between two cars and wait for each other to pass before they can continue through. It would take a half an hour to drive the twins to school, nursery school. And now she can just like zip down one road and zip down another and say, at the same time, culturally and architecturally, East Lansing has absolutely nothing to offer compared to London and compared to places like Richmond, where she lived at one point, or to Hampton Hills. She lived right near Hampton Court Palace. She really yearns for that architecture and the sophistication of the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I think people in the academic world travel a lot, and this is how we mostly fill those gaps for ourselves. And we kind of look past the relative bleakness of Lansing. The campus is beautiful, but parts of East Lansing are beautiful and the rest not, Lansing not. And you just have to kind of skip over that and remember the times that you went to South America or Italy or England or Scotland or somewhere to make up for that. But I would never leave, because escaping the winters would mean escaping all my friends and every place that I'm accustomed to. The older I get, the more I want to drive familiar streets and see familiar people and go to the same places where I've gone for theater and restaurants and recreation and stuff. So, no, I won't be leaving.
Fine. Well, thank you very much, Kay.
Thank you, Pauline, for inviting me.
You have added much to our accumulation of lore about Michigan State and about the people who have dedicated a good part of their lives to Michigan State.
Thank you.
Thank you again.